Apartment people, my name is Dave, and I bring you good news. From Champion, River Park of Dublin, it's a brand new community now open and leasing. I've been to it. It's kitchen clean. And they've got a new enticement. You get 2 months free when you sign a 12-month or longer lease, and you move in by the beginning of October. Everything's new. New pool, new fitness center, free Starbucks coffee, EV charging stations, parking, garage. River Park of Dublin. Now make the move, literally. LiveWithChampion.com. Schedule a tour. LiveWithChampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Welcome to Break the Case. I'm your host. I'm Jen Coffendaffer. We have the best guest joining us today to talk a lot about the John O'Keefe case. I call it the John O'Keefe case. Karen Reed is on trial for the murder of John O'Keefe, specifically charged with second degree murder, also with manslaughter, and also with leaving the scene of an accident that resulted in a death. Specifically in January, 2 years ago, she was driving John O'Keefe to a party at a local police officer's home. This is undisputed. What is disputed is what happened after they arrived at the home. According to the prosecution, Karen Reed was drunk. Also, according to the evidence, Karen Reed was angry. According to the evidence, we've all heard the voicemails. For those of you who haven't, I challenge you to listen to them. And according to the prosecution, she went to leave, then threw her Lexus SUV in reverse, hit John O'Keefe, sort of clipping him and knocking him to the ground, where he suffered a brain injury fracture and ended up dying, both due to hypothermia combined with his head trauma. So according to the defense, they say, no, that's not what happened. They say that John O'Keefe was dropped off, went into the house where 11 individuals were, and that three of the individuals and a dog in the house, an ATF agent, a 30-year police veteran, a 17-year-old, and a dog named Chloe attacked John O'Keefe and killed him and then threw him in the front yard. So those are the two different opposing views on this case that have been offered. But we're going to talk about, we don't have our second trial starting yet. The first trial resulted in a hung jury. We're going to talk a lot about that. But joining us is Judge Erskine. I have to give you all her accolades. I have to read them because there's so many. First of all, please get the book, A Cruel Justice. It's about Harmony Montgomery. Harmony Montgomery, who was viciously murdered by her father and was convicted of that crime. And she wrote this book, Judge Erskine, and it's a great book. I challenge you all to get it and read it. It's about what they're doing now, really, to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And it discusses and exposes everything that happened in that case that really led to her just being forgotten for years, honestly, until it was finally realized she was missing. It's one of the most tragic cases. She's also a retired judge in Massachusetts, barred in Massachusetts, an attorney, adoptive mama. I love to hear that because I was adopted when I was an infant, and she has the opposite side of that. She is a mom who adopted children, so we have that close connection. She also is a college educator. Without much further ado, welcome to the stage, Judge. Please come to the stage. Wait 1 second. Let's see if I can make this happen. There she is. How are you,
Judge? Hi, Jen. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, no, we just love you being on. Your knowledge in these matters is so extensive, and it was funny for the audience before we were talking and the judge was giving, you know, a few of her opinions. We were both talking back and forth. I said, Judge, I may challenge you, but I know you know so much more about Massachusetts law than me. So we're going to let Judge explain a lot to us. But let's first get into some of these motions. Judge, can you first talk about where we are at with the decision that is being looked at as to whether the jury's whether there was really a verdict in the first trial? Where is all of that? I know there's been no decision, but what can we expect? I mean, we've got a retrial as soon as April 1st.
Right. I think it's interesting that, you know, the case is set for retrial on April 1st, but they have 130 days by law to issue that decision. So I'm not quite sure when it will come down. I think it was argued on November 6th. And so they have 130 days. And frankly, they often take a lot longer than 130 days. But I think because of the issues in this case, which, you know, are around things like double jeopardy, that they'll make the decision, I think, as soon as they possibly can. But right now, that's where it stands. They've heard all the arguments. It was interesting. I just listened to those arguments again yesterday after I was posting about the Pedro Vasquez, Commonwealth versus Pedro Vasquez, where they brought the jury back over issues of racism and some of the language the court used about safeguarding a defendant's rights in when it comes to jury trial. So it was interesting. I wasn't making any conclusions about it, but I was saying, you know, is what they're saying about protecting these rights and not having the substantial miscarriage of justice, is that, does it give us a lens into how they're thinking? But it's really hard to know. You never know with the SJC. I mean, I've argued cases before the SJC and never really had a clue as to what they were going to decide. But it's such an important issue. And there were so many issues they have to resolve. You know, there was their consent about the declaration of the mistrial. There's the issue of should they bring the jury back, you know, and do a voir dire. So that was an issue. So there are a lot of issues that they have to filter through. It was interesting to listen to the argument and their comments again yesterday.
So this is so fresh in your mind. Did you get any inkling from what took place and what you listened to as to what way they're leaning?
Yeah, I really didn't. I have to say, I really did not get much from that, because on one hand, you had Justice Kafka, who said something like, I'm having difficulty finding consent when no one was asked. I mean, he really had some concerns about whether or not the judge should have asked for their consent. Instead, they brought the jury in. As the justices are talking about this, you know, the door opens. She has the letter. Judge has the letter. She hasn't shared it with them. And she just reads it and says, okay, I'm declaring a mistrial, and doesn't say anything. And then on the other hand, I can't remember if it was, I think it might've been Justice George's, but one of the other judges said, well, you know, really, what's the obligation of counsel, you know, to ask? I mean, isn't there some obligation of counsel to actually be asking if they want to be heard? So you have these judges going back and forth, and they're pushing back on the defense lawyer, and they're pushing back on the prosecutor. And so you really don't get a sense of where they're going. But it's very interesting. I mean, it's very clear, you know, that they have a lot to consider, that this is a serious issue. Double jeopardy is a serious issue. And there were a lot of questions about bringing the jury back. I mean, the prosecutor said, you know, time has, you know, passed by and people have had external influences. But then one of the judges said, well, you know, we brought people back years later over allegations of racism on the jury. But, you know, that in itself may be a different issue. So I just don't know. I mean, and I've never tried to predict it either, because I never could predict what they were going to do.
Well, I tell you, and I know we discussed this issue previously, but just to touch point on a couple of items. First of all, I do think that the fact that she just didn't declare a mistrial, right? She sent them back, I believe, at least two times to consider and gave them the appropriate warnings and, you know, and the letter that was written by the foreman was so eloquent, really. Mm-hmm. I'm beyond what I've ever seen written by a juror, a juror note. And so I think that that is important. And secondarily to that, for those of us that watched it, and I know you probably did, I mean, Karen Reed's counsel was chomping at the bit for that mistrial. Are we ready? Is it a mistrial? I'm sort of exaggerating their motions, but wow, were they pleased, I thought, to get the mistrial is how I read the language of it. So
because you're very, very right about that. I mean, and the justices mentioned that. They said, well, what was going to be different? You know, I mean, first you have the first one, and then, you know, they're asking about Tui Rodriguez, and they're saying, no, let them go back. And then you have the second one, and you're asking them about Tui Rodriguez. And one of the justices said, you know, when they're saying, yes, let's do a Tui Rodriguez, you know, are they really looking for a verdict, or, you know, or is it pretty clear, you know, that, you know, there's the potential for a mistrial at that point? So, you know, the things you're saying were absolutely raised by the justices of the SJC, saying, you know, they had two other opportunities. Was anything really going to change with a third opportunity? And of course, defense counsel was, yes. And what changes is, it's not the burden of the defense to step in and say, hey, I want to say something, or I want you to pull. It's the judges or the Commonwealth's burden. And not their burden. So, you know, it goes both ways. But the things you're saying absolutely were raised by the justices.
So last question on this point, and I just think this point is just so important. Obviously, will there be a ruling before the second trial? Doesn't there have to be?
Well, like I said, the rule is 130 days. So that's what, 3.5 or 4 months. So that's to December, January, February, March. I mean, you know, I suppose if they stick by it, it would be maybe sometime in March. But I suspect in this case, you know, knowing just the sheer magnitude of it, and it's not like they don't know how big this case is, that they'll have a decision, which I hope will be soon. And they just released the Pedro Vasquez decision. And so that's out. And so my hope is that this one is next in line and people will know, because obviously they can't proceed on April 1st until they know, because it, you know, the whole question is, are they going to find that, you know, double jeopardy attached? And I don't know how they're going to find that without the jurors coming back in. That's really the argument. I think if they were to do anything, I think maybe they would say you have to bring the you know, the jurors back in. But I hope it's going to be soon. I think, you know, I'm sure they're aware of the next trial date, but they have to know, because everybody's talking about, well, there's a second murder trial. We really don't know that, do we?
Yeah, it's so interesting. And again, just for the audience, there are two verdicts, if you will, that are being argued, right? One, it has to do with the second degree murder, and the other has to do with the leaving the scene that results mm-hmm. in a death, just so everybody knows. But count two would still, even if they say that's double jeopardy attached to the first and third, mm-hmm. number two was the manslaughter.
That's right.
Everybody agrees that that was a 9-3 in favor of guilty, but obviously hung, because mm-hmm. 3-3.
Yeah. I mean, if it's 11-1, it's hung, you know, and the numbers never really matter. And the only number that matters is 12. And so, you know, that's really all that matters at this point.
Well, let's move on to some of the most recent decisions that were made. I first want to talk about Voss. Gretchen Voss is a writer for a magazine that interviewed in depth Karen Reed. And we know it was decided, it came out on January 31st, that indeed her handwritten notes would not be allowed. The prosecution wanted them in, I'm surmising, because, and this was discussed, she had some opinions on there. And that was acknowledged because the judge saw these statements in camera and she said, well, why can't we just sort of redact out the opinions but keep in the other? Anyway, the ruling came down from Judge Cannone. No, no handwritten notes from Gretchen Voss. What do you think, A, about the ruling, and B, do you think it was the correct ruling?
Well, I think, the judge made really clear that the prosecutor didn't have sufficient evidence to overcome countervailing interests of the press. You know, there's First Amendment issue of the free press, and then there's the safeguarding issue under shield laws. So under both of those, journalists, the reason they're shielded is because you want the free flow of information, which is the language that the judge used. She said that Hank Brennan's motion was insufficient to overcome the countervailing interest of the free flow of information, meaning that you can't have journalists interviewing people and having people worry that what they're saying, if they're saying it, you know, confidentially to a journalist, because the journalist is like, I'm not going to say what you said to me, and they keep these private notes. So that's what she was looking at. Interesting thing is, aside from the lawyer who represented Voss, there were other memoranda filed by other news media. And it's interesting because I've never seen a case that's had so much media attention than the Reed case. But the minute someone says, okay, now we want the media, we want the media to turn over information so we can use it at trial. And they say, oh, no, we don't want to go that far. But the fact of the matter is, you know, she was right. You know, there are constitutional issues, free press, and then there are shield laws. And then there's the whole issue of safeguarding a journalist's right to have those notes and to be able to tell people that they're not going to reveal their sources. And she just didn't think that Brennan's motion and affidavit was enough to overcome that. And that's why she denied it. She made it very clear that this just didn't overcome the issue of the free flow of information.
Yeah, interesting. I think it was so important for the judge to review these notes in camera. And I think in this way, she was able to even make a better decision. But let me know if I'm wrong on this, because was this strictly based on law, or did she keep into account the notes and reading them?
That's a great question, because of course, you know, when the initial decision came out, people were celebrating, oh, we're going to get Voss's notes because the notes were going to be brought into the court. Well, it's an in-camera review. I mean, I've done a lot of in-camera reviews, because in child abuse cases, a lot of times the Department of Children and Families would want the private therapy notes of the child or the private therapy notes of the parent. And so the only way to determine, you know, under the standard, you know, whether this privilege that was given to children and parents and with these notes, the only way to determine that, to see whether or not it was going to be relevant enough and there were going to be factors to overcome the privacy, was to do an in-camera review and to read those notes and then make a decision. So, I think that's a great question. That's exactly what she did. She read the notes, and that was part of the decision where she said, you know, I have to safeguard, Voss's, I have to safeguard Voss's note-taking. Otherwise, I'm really delving into violating the free flow of information and safeguarding those rights with the First Amendment issue. So she definitely read them. So it makes you wonder, you know, what's there. But I think she made the decision that the prosecution really didn't make the case for how enough so that they were relevant or needed at trial. That was also part of the problem.
Yeah, you know, my experience with in camera was with judges about informants.
Mm-hmm.
So I would go in there, bring my informant files, and the judge would go over what the informant had to say. And of course, our argument was, we cannot let this informant's name out. We just cannot. And, or not only not the name, but the singular type information. In other words, we had to keep it very focused, even though that's what they wanted. And I can't think of one instance where the judge ruled that any informant information that was singular or certainly not the identification of an informant would be allowed.
Right.
And it's just for the reasons you're stating right here, except for it's informant law enforcement versus journalist citizen.
Right. It's the same analysis, basically. I mean, that's really what you're saying, and you're right. It's exactly the same analysis. Whether I was doing it for, you know, privileged for therapist records, privacy of child statements to a therapist, or whether it's doing it for an informant, or whether it's doing it for the Free Press, it's all the same kind of balance and looking at, you know, what are the issues on this side and what are the issues on that side based on my decision. So I think it was the right decision. But, you know, again, it's kind of another loss for the prosecution that seems to be running a prosecution that's more directed towards the evidence and forensic issues rather than all this stuff that went on in the first trial. This sort of defensive prosecution of having all these Alberts and McCabes and all these police officers and a lot of witnesses that really didn't add much to it. He seems to be tending away from that. I could just be guessing about that, but seems a lot more focused on honing in on the evidence and the forensic evidence based on these motions.
Yes, I hope so. I hope the order of proof switches. It should be the strong proof of this crime that represents what their belief is in terms of what happened, not defending what the defense is going to say that the jurors haven't even heard. So I agree with you that hopefully that's what we're seeing is this change in direction. And I know, you know, many of us were a little confused about why they did that in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Get round two here. One other quick question, and then we can leave the Voss issue. But as if I were on the prosecution team, I would strongly want those notes. And this is why. Because we already have seen her admit to so much on national television. She even says, quote, he did not look, I'll paraphrase a teeny bit, but I think this is close to a quote. He did not look like he was mortally wounded. I believe that's an exact quote. You know, after she says, I think I could have clipped him, you know, hit him in the knee and he fell to the ground. But he didn't look mortally wounded, which infers that she looked at him and saw him and left him and that she didn't think he was mortally wounded. So my point is, Judge, what other miscomms did she say to Greg? Mm-hmm. Did she say, well, yeah, I hit him, and then she wrote that down? I mean, I don't know. I would have wanted that, but they're not going to get it, so I guess it's a moot point.
Yeah, they're not going to get it. And I think the interesting thing about that is when she said that, was she referring to, you know, that she saw him that night, or was she referring that when they uncovered the body and she was there and she saw him, that he didn't look mortally wounded? I guess you could. I don't know. You know, what she was referring to. And yes, I think they wanted the notes, but, you know, I think the balance, you know, the balance is there. I strongly doubt that she sat there with Boss and said, you know, I did hit him. I mean, really, after all this time, I mean, I think she knows enough not to say that, but I also think she has said way too much. And I guess I'm surprised that her lawyers, I've never ever seen a case where lawyers are like, yeah, go ahead and have interviews and say what you want and be out in the public. I'm very surprised by that, you know, because no, it's like every time you open your mouth, you know, you're doing some damage because someone's going to cross-examine. Well, if she's not going to testify, but some of those statements are going to come out, and then it's going to be left to the jury to interpret what those statements mean. I mean, is that what you want? I mean, there've been many interviews, and I don't know, just 2020 and Dateline and all these other things. I'm totally shocked that this would happen before there's a verdict, but it is what it is. And, you know, she's going to have to live with a lot of the statements that she made if they come in.
Yeah, it was the Dateline. Actually, she says very similar statements in the 2020 about, well, I think I could have hit him. But then in the Dateline, she goes into so much more specificity. She mm-hmm. talks about how loud it was and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But she is definitely talking about she didn't think it was mortally wounded connected with hitting him if she clipped him. But I will say, I don't know if they cut and splice things. Mm-hmm. And that's why they need the totality yeah. of an interview just to make sure that the question went with the answer. So I agree with you there. Certainly how they have it spliced or how it
right.
is.
I don't know. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the fact of the matter is, I don't think we really know, you know, because they edit, obviously, because they edit so much. So I think it would be hard to say exactly what happened. I mean, a lot of this, I think, goes back to, even if she said things like that, I know I've said this to you before, and I said this on Court TV, I wish they hadn't, in my view, overcharged her instead of charging her with murder. I think if they had charged her from the beginning under Massachusetts law with the OUI leaving the scene of death or injury, which still in itself carries a potential house of correction or prison sentence, I think they might have been able to move forward, maybe with a plea or something like that. But I think when they stepped it up and said, we're going to charge her with murder, then you started to see all this other information coming out in terms of their position regarding a third party. You know, it's a third party defense. Someone else did it. That's their defense.
You know, Judge, I have a question on that, though. So grand jury, right? Initially, the charges were manslaughter and leaving the scene resulting in death, like you said. And then it was upticked to murder two, which my understanding is the reason that happened was any reasonable person should know if you throw your car in reverse and hit somebody, even if you clip them, you have taken on the responsibility of striking them with a vehicle that could mortally wound them. And thus, that is why they upped it to murder two.
I don't know. To me, that description fits manslaughter. You know, it's like the sort of in law school, like if you fire a gun into a train and someone dies, you're not going to be charged with murder, but it's manslaughter. You know, there was not the intent, but, you know, you should have known kind of thing. But and so it's always hard to know. Grand juries, I mean, there's no defense lawyer at a grand jury, as you know. It's only a prosecutor or with an FBI agent or with a police officer or a state trooper who's ever doing the investigation. I mean, there's no chance to say really anything to the contrary. That's the thing. There's no chance to really say much to the contrary, as you know. So, you know, the old expression, you know, you can indict a ham sandwich, it's been around for like 100 years. It's easy to indict.
Yeah, I will say, though, and I have to stick up a little bit here for the grand jury process from the standpoint of when I've been in there, which has been dozens and dozens of times on cases, I can't even count. And I'm grilled. I mean, you think I get grilled on Twitter. actually, everybody's quite polite, but they grill you oftentimes. Yeah, but how do you know this? What does this really mean? You always have about five or six that are really paying attention. Now the others are knitting, some are reading the paper, some are sound asleep, but you have those that are truly invested and they are grilling you about the evidence and they're acting like defense attorneys, but I agree with you. They're not educated like a defense attorney to know
right
the law, but they do ask great questions and common sense, and you better be able to back up your findings with the evidence you're presenting. So just having been behind all these closed doors, sometimes for 8 hours on the conspiracy cases, you know, just hours and hours of evidence. I have found that, I know they say a ham sandwich, but truly some people don't get indicted. It's a small percentage. And then, of course, a lot of times there's nothing happens. There's no true bill. There's no bill. It just sort of languishes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it stays just out there for a long time. I agree with that. And I agree with grand juries. I mean, we see because in my court, in the juvenile court, in order to try, for example, a firearms case or shooting that didn't result in murder, in order to not try them as a juvenile delinquent where the maximum sentence would be commit to DUS until 18, if they're indicted, then that would give me the authority to treat them as a youthful offender. And I could order a juvenile sentence, or I could order an adult sentence, including a house of correction or jail sentence or both. And, you know, so a lot of people, there were a lot of motions filed that there was a lack of probable cause in the grand jury. And so in those motions, the grand jury minutes are there. And so, you know, as a judge, you see grand jury minutes. I have great respect for the grand jury process. I do think the majority of people take it very, very seriously because they're deciding extremely serious things, oftentimes with a lot of victims. So I totally agree. I mean, I can't say enough about how amazing it is to see these people on the grand jury do their job.
It's great. Judge, this gives me just this quick second to, I want to let everybody know about Aura. It's identity protection. And I have to tell you, I was thrilled when I was asked if I could represent this product. And Judge, this is why I believe in it. And I hate to see people being scammed. I hate to see their identification being taken. And this does VPN safe browsing, credit monitoring. It also monitors transactions and anything that comes up that's unusual. It alerts you. It's just really good, and full antivirus for your devices. So I just want to say to the audience, think about it. It's 2 weeks for free. There's a code at the end. And if you're interested, give it a shot. Okay, let's move on to the ARCA experts, because this is actually pending. And Judge, do you want to go over a little bit this motion? Because my understanding is the prosecution is saying, we want a Daubert hearing for them, or we don't want them to testify. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, it's not my understanding that they've asked for a Daubert hearing. I mean, I think that they concede that these people are clearly qualified. And I don't think they challenged their qualifications at the first trial, but I don't remember. But they obviously testified. At this point, when you look back at the first trial, she allowed them to testify. Although I have to say, I was a little surprised at the way that was done, because the judge said, yes, they can testify, but they can't tell the judge who hired them and where they're from. I thought that was incredibly confusing for jurors. It's like, you can listen to these experts, and they clearly were experts, and I don't think they were challenged. I mean, they had amazing credentials as engineers and, you know, reconstruction or construction experts. And so there was clearly, in my view, there was no question regarding their expertise. You know, both engineers, highly qualified, extremely educated, lots of degrees and certifications. Their testimony was, I thought, impressive. And I think the prosecution's worried about that, because if they testify, and this is the heart of the issue, right? Did she hit him? Was it the car that caused his injury? This is the very heart of the issue in this case. And so really, when you look at this, you have to say, okay, I can see why they don't want them. But the only thing that I've seen that they have filed is a Rule 14 motion, which is pretrial discovery. And, you know, essentially what they're saying is, hey, look, you know, we need to know everything about their background, like their, not only their education, but their employment and all this other information in their background, which would come from the federal government. And it's really slow, and we're entitled to reciprocal discovery from the defense. And it's not the fault of the defense. I mean, they come right out and say, they're not doing anything negligent. They're not delaying it. It's not their fault. But we're just here to tell you, Judge, that the time factor isn't going to work. We're not going to get that information in time for reciprocal discovery. So you should just not let these experts testify. I think that's an incredibly weak argument, if that's the only argument, but that's the only argument that I've seen, because there are just too many other alternatives. I mean, the judge, unfortunately, I know she wants that trial on April 1st, but you can't say that, you know, these expert witnesses who are highly credentialed, and there's no Daubert, I don't think there's any Daubert Lanigan challenge whatsoever, to say they can't testify because there's a Rule 14 issue. Well, then it's up to the judge to say, well, we'll have to wait for discovery, and the trial's going to be May 1st. I mean, I'm not entirely sure, but the only thing that I have read is that they've challenged this under Rule 14, saying we're not going to get discovery in time. So don't let these people that are being called by the defense on the most material and relevant fact of this trial, and with a defendant who has a Sixth Amendment right, particularly under the compulsory process clause, to call her witnesses, a constitutional right, and to say, and for a judge to say, well, I'm not going to let them come in under this Rule 14 discovery. I think it's a red herring myself, you know, to make that argument, but I mean, they've made it. I just can't even imagine that a judge would accept it. And one of the reasons I can't imagine a judge would accept it is because I think that if they weren't allowed to call that witness, I'm not sure that it wouldn't be an interlocutory appeal where they would go up and say to the appeals court, hey, we're being denied over a Rule 14 issue. Or if she were convicted, I think it would be a very strong issue for appeal. I've said this all along. I said this on Court TV about the Russell Daubert hearing and about some of these motions that have been filed. Karen Reed's the only person in the entire courtroom that has Sixth Amendment privilege. She's the only one. So I guess I'll leave it at that.
So a couple of thoughts on ARCA. And by the way, 100% agree with everything you said there. But that in terms of ARCA, just these two things. Yes, they were originally paid for by DOJ. Everybody likes to say the FBI. It was the DOJ that paid for them. It really is two different. Yes, the FBI is under DOJ, but my understanding is this investigation was fully put forth by the U.S. Attorney's Office, and that happens sometimes as an agent. Most of the time, FBI agents get the case and bring them to the prosecutor, but sometimes the prosecutors have the cases and bring them to the FBI, and I think that was the case here. And I think the DOJ paid for, obviously, their initial investigation that they did, but I just want to make sure everyone understands. Make no mistake, the DOJ did not pay a dime of their travel expenses, hasn't paid a dime of their expenses to be pre-tried with the defense team, not a dime for any other investigation that was done by them. Mm-hmm. Since this is all now, it's all being paid for by the defense. I only say that because a lot of people think for some reason that DOJ, the FBI, other people are paying for them, and that's just not the case. They would have paid for that initial report, and then that ends the involvement by DOJ, FBI with ARCA.
Right, because their involvement was not to be investigating the Norfolk DA or the state in that sense. I mean, maybe they were, I don't know, they were looking at how they were looking at the process, but I don't think, you know, it's one thing for the FBI to send an agent to Washington, D.C. to testify in a case that they're actively involved in and that where they have filed the charges. But in this case, I don't think anything's been filed by the FBI. So there wouldn't be any reason for the FBI or the DOJ to pay. But at the same time, she's still entitled to have those witnesses. And if it falls on her, it falls on her. That's different to me than hiring, you know, Dr. Russell and finding her and paying her. You know, I mean, the jury can look at that and say, okay, she's a paid person, and they can consider that. That, you know, always comes up when people are paid. I totally get that. This is a little bit different, don't you think? Because they weren't looking necessarily for these people. They just sort of fell into their lap, and then they said, okay, we want them to testify. Well, someone has to pay them to testify. It's not as, you know, I don't think it's not as much of an issue as it would be when they're paying someone else to come in and give an opinion. Not that it means the opinion is worthless just because it's a paid expert.
I totally see your point. And yeah, absolutely. When you look at Dr. Russell, who contacted them.
Right.
Pick me. I'd like to help your case. That's so different from this standpoint. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, what really has always bothered me about ARCA, and I've pointed this out on numerous occasions, I'd love to get your take on this, is the fact that because the DOJ was doing this as a public corruption investigation, they got no information from the DA or from the state police. And so they were working blindly, not knowing, for instance, that there was no K9 DNA on the shirt, that there weren't pieces of that taillight all over the crime scene, that, you know, his phone was underneath him, that all witnesses said he never came inside, that the taillight is small, tiny fragments are embedded in his shirt when he was hit. All his DNA was on the taillight. His hair was on the bumper. They did not look at any of that. And as an expert, you have to consider inculpatory and exculpatory evidence. You can't just say, I'm just going to look over here. And that has been my biggest argument with them, is they didn't look at the inculpatory until they said sort of on the stand, well, yeah, we were showed that. And yeah, that wasn't really important. And we don't need to really consider that or words to that effect. That's been my problem, Judge.
Yeah, and I totally understand that. And everything you said is perfectly reasonable and appropriate. But it's not the basis for keeping them out under Daubert-Lanigan. It's a basis for cross-examination. I mean, all those things that you raise are going to be raised by the prosecution. But, you know, to keep them out under a Rule 14 discovery, I can't see that happening. I'll be shocked if it happens. And the likelihood is they will testify. And then it's up to the prosecution to do exactly what you're talking about now, and that is challenge them. You didn't see this, and you didn't see that, and you didn't look at the state reports, and you didn't evaluate this data, did you? Then it's up to the jury to say, you know, I don't know if I actually trust what their ultimate, you know, what their ultimate recommendation or their ultimate conclusion was. If their ultimate conclusion was there's no way that he was hit by a car, and then the jury looks at it and thinks about the issues that you said, you know, they may reject that. That's the, you know, the whole point behind a trial is to, you know, put your witnesses on, hear the cross-examination, and then let the jury decide how much weight they want to give to that opinion. So all those things you're saying, I agree with like 1,000%. It's just that they're the subject of cross-examination, not a Daubert-Lanigan motion, and certainly not to keep them out on a Rule 14 motion, at least in my view. I think she'll allow them to testify, but I think the cross-examination will be a lot tougher this time around than it was the first time, because the prosecution has a lot more information about what they actually didn't see and didn't do. So we'll see.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. Totally think they're going to be allowed in. I think the discovery argument is weak, the Rule 14, and agree with you that that's what we're going to see happen. So that's a prediction, everyone. We might be wrong, but that's our prediction.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you okay on time?
Oh, yeah, fine.
Okay, good. Just we have a few more to discuss. What do you think, and this is the weirdest motion to me, I've never seen anything like this one, that the defense says, listen, we were supposed to be able to send an expert to review the video machine from a Sally port. Why was it inverted? You know, what, blah, blah, blah. I guess to look at this video machine. And they send an expert, and then supposedly there's nothing on the hard drive, I guess, to extract.
Right.
Which, I mean, I have so many questions about that, because what I'm picturing on this machine is nothing colossal. I'm not picturing this, you know, elaborate system. At least I'm not. And it, there seems to be just total crosswire on what was going to be there, and they're upset it wasn't there, and they want the government to pay. What do you think about this one?
Yeah, I don't even know what to think about that, you know, because everybody sort of agreed that their expert could examine it. But on the other hand, this was on a hard drive, and I could be wrong about this, but where it sort of erases itself after a certain number of days, I think that that's what I read. So it wasn't going to be available because it sort of records over. Yeah, I don't really have a lot to say about that, because I'm not sure, you know, there has to be something, I think, that the Commonwealth did, you know, sort of affirmatively, I guess I would say, to sort of preclude this expert from doing what he was brought to do. So I don't have a lot to say about it, because it's hard to know. I mean, I think they knew that this person was coming, and I thought there was some understanding that this person would have access to this, but I don't know that the prosecution even knew that that information wouldn't be available because it had been erased. And if the prosecution didn't know, then I don't know why they would be required to pay. I think unless the prosecution did something kind of dodgy or hinky or, you know, something, you know, affirmative, I guess is the word I would use to sort of prevent them from getting this expert to view that. Unless that happened, I can't see that they're going to, that the judge would say, well, you have to pay for it. Because I don't know that it was something that the prosecution did. I mean, I could be wrong about that, because you probably know more about it than I do, but not a heck of a lot of information about it. But I know when Brendan argued, you know, in the opposition motion, I think they said, you know, we did everything that we were supposed to do. You know, we complied, we said yes. I think that his position was it didn't fall on us. We didn't do anything in any kind of affirmative sense or anything sneaky in order to stop this. So I'm not sure how she's going to have to just read that and see where it fits in. But I didn't see the prosecution doing anything, you know, that where the state would have to pay for it.
Yeah, I this is how I think it played out. I think that they got that hard drive, they downloaded everything and presented it to the defense a long time ago. The defense, I think, has had all the information regarding that Sally Port recording, but it wasn't the original, if you will, right? Because they had to extract it and make copies for everyone. The prosecutor, the defense team, the judge, the court. I mean, you have to make all these multiple copies of all this evidence. Then you have the evidence that actually stays in the evidence room. And then when you bring to trial and blah, 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 right? Multiple copies. And so I think, just as you said, that as time went on, that hard drive only held so much.
Right.
It was just recorded over, but it was sequential because it had already been handed over 2 years before.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, there's a time factor there, so I don't think she's going to order it. It's interesting. I noticed one of the comments, you know, because there's some sound coming back. Someone saying, "Oh, turn the fan off, Carol." But I just want to say I have nothing on. It's very quiet here, so I think people are maybe picking up some.
I heard that a little bit too, just a little bit of shh, but I didn't know what it was. It seems gone now.
Yeah, now it is. So just so you know, I'm very careful about these podcasts and court TV about not having anything in the background. But anyway, so I think that's that. I think, you know, one of the I think one of the, for me, I think one of the big motions was the Lampron motion, as they're called in Massachusetts, which was Hank Brennan's request to get Bill Reed's phone. I couldn't believe it when I read that, because in order to delve into the privacy of someone's phone or into the privacy of their records, I mean, they really, Lampron, the case is Commonwealth versus Lampron, judges have to do an analysis of that. And there's this sort of protocol in Massachusetts, the Lampron and Dwyer protocol. But, I mean, he's such a seasoned, experienced attorney. I was very surprised that he filed this, because I didn't see any way that he was going to get it, because the factors like relevancy and materiality, he couldn't make out a case for that at all. I was absolutely shocked. I mean, first of all, if they have the information some other way, then a judge isn't going to allow it, because it's only one of those factors is you can't get the information any other way. Well, they already knew what the phone calls were by Karen Reed. They already knew that because they have her phone. And so, you know, it's like, why are they asking? Because it can't be duplicative information. And then, so on materiality and relevance under Lampron, the argument was she called her father at 1:30 in the morning. The phone call was never answered. But what he was saying is that, but the reason we want to look at his phone, and first of all, it has to be very narrow when you're invading someone's privacy. So they asked for Bill Reed's phones from December 30th to January 30th. Well, this thing happened, you know, the whole event happened on January 29th. Why would he file this motion saying, well, we want all of his phone calls, everything on his private phone for essentially 2 months? Made no sense. I don't think the judge found that it made any sense. And certainly the defense's arguments opposing it were very clear to say this doesn't, it becomes, as they call it, as you know, from being in courts, a fishing expedition. And really, that's, I think, the way it looked. But the thing that surprised me most about the Lampron motion was they said that phone call at 1:30 in the morning meant that she was calling her father because she knew she hit him, she knew she backed into him, and she knew she left him there to die. I mean, so the Lampron motion, you know, basically said that's the reason that we're entitled to these, because an unanswered phone call meant, and we can infer to the jury, that she hit him, that she knew she hit him, that she intended to hit him, and that once she hit him, she left him there to die. I mean, to me, I don't even have a word for that. I mean, it's beyond absurd. And, you know, that would be the proffer on a Lampron motion. And what did the judge say? She only waited a day before she issued her decision and wrote at the bottom of it said, on its face, it doesn't meet the Lampron criteria. On its face. I mean, that's a bit of a slap in the face to the prosecutor, but because she didn't say, you know, after, you know, reviewing all the motions and all the memorandum and all the affidavit and weighing each side in the balance, I find that it doesn't meet the necessary criteria to invade one's privacy. But that's not what she said. I mean, she just sort of unceremoniously said, on its face, this doesn't meet the criteria for Lampron or Rule 13A2. So I was very surprised about that. And the reason that I'm always interested in that Lampron motion in terms of what they said, you know, meaning that they made this argument that the jury could infer that she was calling him to say, oh, by the way, I hit John and I backed into him and I left him, you know, because I was mad. Which, again, to me, I couldn't believe it when I read it. But I think and I ask myself why he's an incredibly experienced attorney, you know, highly regarded in Massachusetts, been a defense attorney for many years. And I'm thinking, why would he file that? Because he had to know it wasn't going to meet the Lampron criteria. It was pretty evident. But what maybe it says to me is that their main concern is intent and that they're having difficulty establishing that element, and that using getting his phone, getting that phone in there, that maybe there was something, or maybe that unanswered call, which is what they talked about, would somehow establish some kind of intent, because they could infer that that was her intent to the jury. I was just asking myself, I mean, as a lawyer and as a judge, I'm thinking, why is he filing that? You know, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. But I'm going to say what I've said all along, and that is, I think, there was an effort to sort of move this to a second degree murder. And that brings in all the necessity of having to prove that intent element, which is legally, I think, very difficult in a case like this, as opposed to OUI leaving the scene of death or injury, you know, which I think would have, you know, I think could have resulted in a conviction or could have resulted in a plea. I don't know. But it's obviously too late for that now.
All right, Judge, I'm going to push back a little bit from an investigative lens. I was so happy to see him try to get those records, but I was agree with you. To me, it should have been the 29th, 30th, and that's it.
Absolutely right.
The 30th, and then you have to stop.
Yeah.
And the reason is, what they wanted really was the voice message to him, which they don't have. What did she say? And I thought she called him twice, but maybe it was only the one time.
I think she called the dad and then the mom.
Okay.
I could be wrong, but you know, it's just so many facts in this case. But I think there were two calls.
Yeah, but nevertheless, that to me was what they were looking for. And then, of course, when was there a barrage of phone calls later? You know, that obviously they have the one side, they have Karen's side. But what did he do? Mm-hmm. Did he immediately, when he woke up at whatever time, did he start calling attorneys? Did he call? And so as an investigator, I would want to hear the voicemail she left. And I would want to know what he did in the morning when he retrieved, so they would be able to see. He retrieves the voicemail. Mm-hmm. What does he do? And I would want to see. And that should have been it. It should have been literally a 24-hour time frame that they sought. And that was it. And I think they got greedy. Mm-hmm. If they just would have kept it small. So that's one point I wanted to make. So
it's a great point, too. I mean, I think it's a great point, because maybe there was something else in there. I don't think they argued that, because, of course, they don't know. What the only thing they know was from Karen Reed's phone, that those calls took place at 1:30 in the morning and they went unanswered. But what they couldn't say is, well, we think there might be other calls that he might have called a lawyer, because then that comes under the fishing expedition kind of aspect of the Lampron case. So they had to make the case based on what they knew, which put them in a difficult situation where they couldn't do what you're saying. I agree with you 1,000%. Absolutely stunned that they would ask for 2 months. I mean, what could possibly have anything to do with getting his phone records from all of December and all of January, other than for them to say, look at all 2 months. Has she ever called her father at 1:30 in the morning? But then again, you know, how much meaning would that have to the jury? But I just couldn't see it either. But I mean, you make some great points about it.
That was definitely what I think they were trying to establish, some sort of pattern, but they overreached, in my opinion, on that. The second point is, talk about Lampron. Please explain to me how people in the house who weren't outside other than to rush to their cars, which were to the left as you're exiting the house, his body was to the right. It was a blizzard. There was snow. It was freezing. It was slippery. One of the witnesses or more talk about that, you know, and you're from Massachusetts. I grew up in Nebraska. It's freezing. And when all that happens and you're in a blizzard, you are shuffling, because you know your sidewalk when you walk out is going to be ice, because you have snow. It then, you know, turns to ice as it, you know, hits that pavement. And various factors, you're careful. And even if it's not ice, it's slippery, sledgy snow. And so I guess my point is in leaving this house, you know, what, to me, it just made sense.
That in leaving the house, what? That the point is that.
Sorry, Judge, I lost track a little bit of where I was going with this. But the bottom line is with Lampron, these individuals have not been proven to have done anything other than to go to a birthday party, to leave a birthday party, and to trudge across a sidewalk looking down and right. go to their vehicles.
Right. So,
sorry, I left that very.
No. Yeah, I don't know that, you know, that's all. I mean, I think what you're talking about is that's evidence that, you know, is going to be part of the trial, but not addressed in motions. And that's why I think the only Lampron motion that was out there was really regarding Bill Reed's phone. But there are a lot of other phones that were part yes. of the, I think that's what you're referring to, but,
yeah.
but did, I don't know. I can't remember. And I'm sorry about this, whether or not the request for those phones, because the Commonwealth had them, whether they had to provide that information in reciprocal discovery or whether they were Lampron motions about it. Yeah. You're right about that. I just don't remember how that information came in the first trial. You know, in this one, you know, they're looking at an entirely different witness, Bill Reed, right? So that's why all of a sudden there's a new Lampron motion out there to get his records. But I just don't have the recollection because it was so much in the first trial about, you know, the Alberts and the McCabes and their phones. And there was it seemed like for days, there was a lot of testimony about the phones. And I'm not sure how that all that came in, how that was all approved. I just don't remember because there was so many phones that were in text messages that were brought in at that trial. It would be hard to go back and remember what happened in the pretrial period, which would have been the Lampron motions.
Right. So from my recollection, and sorry, I didn't mean to kind of delve down this road and or I knew you would have known this answer. I don't even fully know the answer, but I know a lot of it was provided to the prosecution and then through discovery just because they asked for the records. And mm-hmm. Jen McCabe volunteered everything except mm-hmm. for things to do with her daughter. So a lot of it, you're right, was just the prosecution yep. had it. But yep. I recall Lampron motions definitely, I thought, concerning Higgins and the McCabes and Alberts, I believe. But it's something we can revisit. But my point was, perhaps that's why Brennan sought this, because he said, well, listen, look at how loosely this has been applied to these witnesses. And I remember watching these hearings where they mm-hmm. were like hearings. And I remember thinking, I can't believe this is even happening, which is kind of your reaction to Brennan trying to get Reed's father's phone. And I thought, well, probably the reason they're doing this is because they allowed it for all these witnesses that were in the house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really hard to know because a lot of those people are private citizens. And so it's the same kind of thing as it is with Bill Reed. As far as the officers in law enforcement, I mean, they're part of the investigation. And so maybe there's something different there. But for all these other witnesses whose phones were brought in, I don't know because I just don't remember because, of course, yeah. there were so many pretrial motions. But, you know, the fact of the matter is they were private citizens, too, just like Bill Reed is a private citizen. And so in order to get into the phones of private citizens, there has to be an analysis and you have to show relevancy. You have to show that it's not duplicative. You have to show, you know, why it's relevant and is it material? So there's a standard there that has to be met, but it'll be interesting now that you raise it to go back and see just whether or not they came in whether there were motions to bring them in and whether the judge allowed those motions and whether it was done under Lampron. But the only Lampron motion that we've seen so far in the second trial is with Bill Reed's phone. I don't think they did it with her mother's phone, even though there's something out there about the mother's phone. But I don't think that was included in the motion. But it's an interesting concept to think about. I just don't remember. I mean, there was, first trial, there were probably hundreds of motions. I don't envy Judge Canone of having to do all those motions.
And to your point, this is a whole new trial. So it's what happened in that trial happened. And even though I think it does influence some decisions, right? It wouldn't have made sense for her to allow. She set a lot of precedent in the first trial that she can't reverse. For instance, letting Dr. Russell testify. That's why she's going to let Green probably testify. Oh, this is a perfect segue to our last and most juicy, I think, motion. And this is the motion about Mr. Green. Recall for the audience, Green is the defense expert that really, in my opinion, started this whole notion that at 2:27 in the morning, Jen McCabe Googled how long to die in snow, and that proved in some way, that's where the leap was, that all these people murdered him based on that. That is where people got the shirts, you know, the banners, the bumper stickers. Anyway, to the question here is regarding that, the Green, now they're saying they want a Daubert hearing, but she said no. Canone ruled on the 31st, I can make my ruling about him without a hearing. What does that tell you?
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, I think she realized that, you know, there's a time factor here. And how much time is she going to spend on these pretrial motions? And so I think that's part of it. And to say, I'm going to rule based on the papers, as they say, and based on what they wrote, you know, and not give the defense the chance to go through the criteria, the Daubert-Lanigan criteria. I don't know. It may be that she's more likely to have Green testify. I mean, I look at it, you know, kind of like what I had said on Court TV about Dr. Russell. I mean, here you have a Daubert motion. I was surprised about that. I mean, I've had a lot of expert witnesses, especially in parental rights cases, even in temporary custody hearings, when there's allegations of broken ribs or a fractured skull in a baby or sexual abuse of a child in the home. And has that's been examined by a doctor at the Child Protection Center. And those doctors are called by the state and say, this child, you know, it's my opinion, after going through, you know, basic voir dire, it's my opinion that this child has been sexually abused, or it's my opinion that these rib fractures are done by something intentional. So, you know, I've listened to a lot of experts. And the thing is, you have to remember that always, and this is, as I said on Court TV, that there's, you have this one person, and I keep saying it over and over again, there's only one person who's facing a loss of liberty for the rest of her life. There's only one person that has a Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial. There's only one person that has compulsory process, which is the part of the Sixth Amendment that says a defendant has a right to call their own witnesses. That, so it's a heavy burden when you file a Daubert motion and say, I want to keep this witness out. It's an extremely heavy burden. And so I think it's from the standpoint of the judge, you know, looking at it as a judge saying, well, if I keep this person out, not only are you setting up an appellate issue, because you know if there's a conviction, that's going to be probably the first thing that my client did not even have a right to call her own witnesses. Her Sixth Amendment rights were violated by the judge's decision. And you can see that happening. So it's a risky business, as I've said a ton of times, for a judge to not allow someone to testify. I only did it once in 20 years. It wasn't necessarily on a Daubert, but it was complete. There was just no way that I felt that this witness could testify. And this was on a pretrial matter, kind of like a Daubert hearing, but it was a pretrial matter on interpreting the statute. And it was in a child sex abuse case. And it was about a witness who was going to say that, you know, maybe the child wasn't all that reliable and we should force her to testify. And so I in the pretrial, and then I went on to do the trial and terminated parental rights. And, you know, I talk about this because it's in it, the appeal is public. But I made the statutory interpretation and didn't allow the witness, and I was overturned. It was the only time in 20 years that I didn't allow a witness, and I was promptly overturned by the appeals court saying, well, even though the statute didn't provide any guidance for whether or not this witness could be eliminated, what they said is, look, this parent is in a situation where this parent could lose parental rights. And it's a constitutional issue when it's a high level issue. So lesson learned, because then the case came back and had to be tried again. And that's still out there in the appeals court. And I'm still like angry about it because it's a public case, but, you know, I sort of chuckle, but it was devastating for the children involved in the case who had to wait for the case to be retried. And so when I look at this and Judge Cannone saying, you know, I'm just going to decide based on the papers, you know, my sense is that she's going to allow it and that she's going to allow it because it makes more sense to allow people to have their witnesses and to discredit them on cross-examination. I mean, there's a lot of things that that Mr. Green could be discredited on in terms of cross-examination. And that's really important to let the jury hear it and say, you know what, this guy's methodology. I mean, listen to his methodology. And the final thing I'll say about this is that you had a first trial. And so when a judge decides on a Daubert hearing that a witness can or cannot testify, if a judge says, I'm not going to allow this witness to testify, then the appeal is to say the judge abused her discretion. So you abused your discretion. You know, that's what they said, you know, in my case, you know, well, you kind of abused your discretion in this pretrial because you should have let this person testify. Well, I can understand that. And so I think it's interesting to me that she allowed Dr. Russell and she allowed Green to testify in the first trial. And then if she says no, what does that say? That she abused her discretion the first time around? Or is she abusing her discretion now by not letting that person testify? So it's tricky. I think they'll allow them to testify, but I think you have very good lawyers all around in this with Prosecutor Brennan. He's just an exceptionally seasoned attorney. You have seasoned attorneys and even the new attorney that's coming in from New York, pro hoc vice, you know, allowing to be part of the case in Massachusetts. And these are really competent attorneys. And so they know how to cross-examine. And so I think they'll cross-examine, you know, Green on his testimony under oath the first time about the methodology he used that was subsequently determined, not to be, I don't have the technical background, but not to be the appropriate methodology. And that's what they'll do. And ultimately they'll let the jury decide.
Yeah, 100%. 100% agree with you. Let these experts in, let their witnesses in, let everybody, it's kind of how I feel about discovery too. Open discovery, open up your books, let them look at everything. Nothing should be withheld. And I couldn't agree with you more about the importance of having an individual whose life is on the line in terms of how they know it and going to prison, make their case. One last quick question for you, though, on Judge Green and Judge Erskine, sorry, about Green is this. I know saw recently I posted his mugshot and a police report. He was ultimately charged and then reached a diversion where then after, as long as you do what is agreed upon in the diversion, you're basically, they dismiss the case and it all ends. But of course, the documents are very public. It's nothing that you couldn't find if you went on. So they weren't expunged. I don't know why. I don't think it's normal to expunge unless you're a minor, but I could be wrong. You'll have to let us know that. But my point was they should be used to discredit him because he lied to authorities. What you could put on there are the police and the video. There's a video where he basically said a narrative that did not comport with a video. Mm-hmm. So my question to you is, A, will they legally be allowed to use that on his cross-examination? And B, do you think it could have detrimental impact?
Right. I don't think under Massachusetts law they're going to be allowed to use it. Federal law will allow bad character or bad acts under certain conditions. But the Massachusetts rule, 608B, says that bad character evidence is essentially barred, but and especially in then when you delve further into it, so we are not in line with the federal government. So you were an FBI agent, so your court involvement was all in federal courts where they would allow bad character or prior bad acts. Massachusetts doesn't allow it except under some very, very, very limited exceptions, which don't apply here. The other thing is this thing was a minor thing. It was a misdemeanor. And and again, even if you look at it and evaluate it, you were to evaluate it under federal law, he didn't lie about like a technical issue like that. In other words, what happened to him isn't at all had to do with something that happened in a bar and he fell and he said, these people pushed me, they assaulted me. Had nothing to do, no relationship to what he's going to testify in Massachusetts. And it was a diversion, so it wasn't a conviction. So it's not going to be allowed in Massachusetts because there was no conviction there. So I would say under the Massachusetts rules, in all likelihood, and I'm pretty close to 100% that they're not going to allow that. Normally, as you know, you can impeach a witness. You know, if there's been some kind of lie, like let's say, for example, someone lied on their taxes and signed under oath about their tax submission to the IRS. In some cases, when people lie, you can impeach their credibility. I just don't see it happening here because it's so unrelated. Although, like I said, in federal courts and other courts, if people lie, there's the opportunity to bring about the fact to say, well, you've lied before, right? I mean, you've lied before in a legal proceeding, or you didn't lie in the legal proceeding, but you've lied before and you were arrested or you were charged. Under these circumstances, I don't see it coming in at all. Not under Massachusetts law. It's just not consistent with federal law.
Thank you for that, because, I was getting blown up about that. And I appreciate you at least, letting people know here and there that the federal rules are tighter and they're just different. They're not better or worse. They're just different. Mm-hmm. And of course, each state is also quite different. Right. And I've learned a lot about Massachusetts law and actually Idaho law too. There's a lot of uniqueness in Idaho's law that, I'm learning because as you said, my background is full on federal, never had any charges, never been involved in charges that were state charges, always been federal. I just can't thank you enough. Every time you come on the show, every time you do a tweet, I learn so much. And you truly are a wealth of knowledge. And what I also love about you is you're absolutely unbiased. You come in here and you say, listen, These are how the law is interpreted. This is how I see it through my lens, a legal lens. And I really appreciate that because it's hard to find, especially as you've seen. In fact, a lot of people think I'm too biased against Karen Reed. It's hard because I think I understand the facts, but for this go around, I am really trying to definitely represent both sides. And I hope you come on again because you're just the best at really deciphering all of this for us and having such a great conversation.
Well, thanks. I appreciate you coming on. Your questions are always amazing. I see some of the comments. You definitely have a great group of followers. You know, they're smart. I think their comments tell me, the few that I'm able to see as it's going through, that, you know, they're really thinking about this. And I think many of these folks are just willing to listen to what the law is. What I've tried to do on Twitter and on Core TV, and I don't tweet that often about this, is not get into the evidence and all the things that are happening outside of the courtroom. What I'm trying to do is just say, this is the law of Massachusetts, and this is might be why the decision was made this way. And I never say whether I think Karen Reed is guilty or innocent, because when you're a judge and there's a jury trial, the fact of the matter is I never had any say in that. My job was to make sure that the process and the trial was carried out fairly. My job wasn't to say whether the defendant was innocent or not, was not guilty or guilty. And I still live by that. And so from my perspective, I'm not going to say anything on either side and get and delve into all of the evidence, because, you know, I still have this firm belief that that's up to 12 people. But thanks, Jennifer, as always. I really enjoy talking to you. And I think you ask all the right questions, so I really appreciate it.
And I want to let the audience know again, please, please, A Cruel Injustice about Harmony Montgomery. This is a book that Judge Erskine has authored, and it's really important, I think, to keep the momentum going in terms of what her case really meant and the changes that need to be made, and can't just let it die. So I try every month to feature that book and talk about Harmony and point that book out, because for most of us, I followed that case so closely, and I hope that everybody takes a look at it, purchases it, and features it on their platforms, because this is about a little girl and we don't want that to happen to another.
Yeah, I so much appreciate that. And I will tell you, I was talking to Blair Miller, you know, who's the anchor in Atlanta and who was, of course, and covered the White House in Washington. But I met them, the dads of Jameson, Harmony's brother, when I as a judge, I did Jameson's adoption. And they know you. I mean, Blair said to me a couple of nights ago, you know, I know that podcast. I know of Jennifer. So I know that they appreciate it. I said she's been really great about promoting the book, because we're donating the profit from the book to the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption. So I appreciate it. And I know the Millers do, too. So thank you so much for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully you'll rejoin us again when we get the decision.
Love it. When we get the SJC decision, sure.
Yeah, it's going to be a good one. Thank you again, Judge.
Thanks. Thank you to you and to all your followers commenting. Really appreciate it. Take care, Jen.
Thank you. Everyone, oh my gosh, she is so good. I love to have her on the program. I want to quickly thank the mods for everything they do and did tonight. They had double duty because we did a quick show on Sebastian Rogers earlier today. And then, of course, modding this, which was a longer show because it's very complex, these issues. I love having the judge on again. I'll say it. She is so down the middle, and she acts just like a judge on a bench. And I love that for this platform. That's the kind of guests that I want on that are experts and speak. I do want to say this, though. As an investigator, as a special agent, obviously you would never bring a case to a prosecutor or have it see it go before a jury if you did not believe in that case. I always loved getting the question on the stand as a summary witness when they made the mistake, and most of the time they didn't. But when a defense attorney would say, "And what do you think, Special Agent Coffendaffer? Do you think that person's guilty?" And I'd say, "Yes, I think they're guilty. I would not be here if I didn't think the evidence showed that." So sometimes they would step in it and accidentally ask that question of not just me, but other agents and officers, which is a huge mistake, I think. But my point is, when you're a judge, you have to be neutral and you have to look at the law on both sides. And I just have so much respect that that is done neutrally on this case, because it's so difficult for anybody to be neutral on this case. And I especially want to thank all of you who are willing to look at both sides. Like I said, this is, and same with my Twitter, I invite everybody. I think it makes people better to see other vantage points. It makes you think more. It can change your mind. And so it's really about keeping that open mind in any case, in any investigation. Can't wait to read through these comments. And until next time, may justice be served. Thank you all for joining us.
Apartment people, my name is Dave, and I bring you good news. From Champion, River Park of Dublin, it's a brand new community now open and leasing. I've been to it. It's kitchen clean. And they've got a new enticement. You get 2 months free when you sign a 12-month or longer lease, and you move in by the beginning of October. Everything's new. New pool, new fitness center, free Starbucks coffee, EV charging stations, parking, garage. River Park of Dublin. Now make the move, literally. LiveWithChampion.com. Schedule a tour. LiveWithChampion.com.
Hey there. Are you sitting down? Good. Because Wayfair's end of season sale is here, and you can shop it from your couch. It's Wayfair's Labor Day clearance, and it's on now. Right now, you can score up to 70% off everything home at Wayfair, like up to 50% off outdoor furniture and decor, and up to 70% off area rugs, plus amazing doorbuster deals. And 24-hour surprise flash deals on Wayfair home finds in every style. And get it all with fast shipping on everything right to your door. From furniture to faucets, this is your last chance of the season to score huge deals at Wayfair. Don't let the final days of summer pass you by without shopping these end-of-season savings. So don't wait. Like summer, these savings won't last. Head to Wayfair.com today to score up to 70% off everything home. Celebrate your holiday weekend with can't-miss savings before they run out. Shop Wayfair's Labor Day clearance now through September 2nd at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.